This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Lit Lit Show on Thursday, the 7th of March, 2024. I'm your host, Paul Hazard. On tonight's show, Dr. Bernie Sharrow, and I've probably stumbled through her name, will be talking to us about stuck schools, how they can get unstuck, and whether Ofsted is a help or a hindrance. Let's get to it.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
Welcome to the show this evening. In the studio, we have Bernie Sharrow. Bernie, did I pronounce your name properly?
No.
Oh, dear.
But it's a very
terrible start.
It's a very long name. So it's my name is Bernardita Muñoz Chero, but you can call me Bernie, because be easier. Yeah,
It's a lot easier for me, believe me. So Bernie, that name and yourself, that's a Chilean name. You're from Chile originally.
Yeah, originally I'm from Chile, yeah. And mm-hmm. And my names are from Spain and French ancestors. So that's why it's all the complications.
Of course. Yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah. But you live here now. You're permanently here. Are you in London?
Yeah, this is home. So we moved here around 15 years ago, and so I've been working and researching here for quite some time now. So this is home.
This is home now.
Yes.
Very good.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. So Bernie, you've been doing some work on stuck schools. Now, that's an interesting term, stuck schools. It kind of has a lot of loaded meanings with it.
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What is a stuck school?
Well, interestingly, I think that's why I got interested in conducting research on stuck schools, because the first time I heard the term, it was conceptualized by Ofsted to describe schools that have had less than good grades for more than a decade. So since the overall grades were introduced in Ofsted, they looked at those schools that, despite many, many efforts to improve, the schools got grade threes or fours over all that time. So that was the way Ofsted defined stuck schools. But if you look at the literature, and I, you know, my field is school effectiveness, improvement, and accountability, those three things, how they come together. If you look at the literature, you find that around the 90s, Rosenholz in the States described stuck schools, and she gave it a different meaning. And it meant any school that didn't progress. So this could be at the top of the hierarchy. So it could be a school that is stuck up in a way, or it could be a school as Ofsted is describing, a school that has, in a way, you know, is defined in a deficit way.
Yes. Yeah. That's very interesting. I certainly know here in Northern Ireland, you know, we have that kind of cyclical approach to education, whereby we always have to be reviewing what we're doing. And there's that sense of constant improvement about always being better and always doing things better.
Yeah.
So there probably is that sense, we probably recognize that in Northern Ireland, that you can be a brilliant school, but there's still a margin. You can still be better and you dare not be stuck.
Yeah. So I think every system, you know, we always want to push standards. The world is changing, and is this the whole conception of school improvement is this idea that there'll always be areas where you can improve. Mm-hmm. But what we know now is that if you look, for example, if you compare the best countries that they have performed in PISA, in this international assessment by OECD, you know, sure, there's a lot of people that are against PISA, but if we just take it as face value, PISA, you will realize that those school systems that perform the best at the top, let's say Finland or other school systems, they don't have inspections at all.
That's true.
Or they have maybe monitoring visits that is really a professional conversation, mm-hmm, where the school will have their own agenda and support will be given to them. So the way we have developed inspection in the UK, but particularly in England, and well, Wales now is moving away from that model, it's one of the options, and one that produced a lot of unintended effects. So, you know, the inspections are meant to challenge and to, you know, the mission of Ofsted is being a force for improvement.
Can we come back to that in one little second, Bernie?
Yeah.
Can I ask you then, are you saying that there is a direct correlation between not having inspections and successful schools?
No, I'm saying that there are different ways in which you can implement a type of a review, following up, etc. And the one we are choosing in England in terms of it works through putting pressure on schools.
Yes.
That one has some positive effects. So there are some research that shows improvement in students' outcomes. Mm-hmm. But it has a lot of unintended effects, mm-hmm, that have to do with this stress that is put from the accountability system into the school. So then you get well-being issues, mental health problems, and a lot of other unintended effects. And those come hand in hand for the type of inspection system we have chosen. Mm-hmm. There are other types of inspection systems that put less pressure, and they are built on trust, mm-hmm, on the profession, that, mm-hmm, produce less unintended effects. Therefore, at the end of the day, they seem to be more effective if what you want to do is to improve the quality of the system.
Yeah, yeah. I can see that, and I would agree with that. The unintended impact of the kind of really scrutinizing inspections that we have is a huge price to pay.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be convinced that inspections actually raise standards. I think they change things in schools, but I'm not sure they change standards or outcomes.
I think it's really interesting to look at those both sides of, so, you know, that's why I'm so interested in inspections as a form of accountability, because you can have a curriculum, you can have standards, but what is measured is what will guide the whole system.
Yes.
So I agree that one thing are the standards or the curriculum or what we think good quality is, but whatever is assessed then or measured, then that's where we will, you know, all the whole system will look at those critical points. So there's a lot of, so some of the unintended effects, for example, that it's well reported in many studies, is that we end up narrowing down the curriculum, and focusing only on those areas that, you know, math and science and literacy, and what happens with arts and with music and with all those things lose importance, relative importance when we are evaluating the quality. And that's a huge loss as well, because what we need, you know, with the world that is changing, what we need is creativity, a lot of things that are not going to be expressed in a test or in a type of inspection in this way.
And surely that comes down then to values and who decides what is the function of a school?
Definitely. Definitely. It's a very, you know, political, and it's a vision that you have in schools, in a system. Mm-hmm. And therefore you designed a system to monitor that. I agree. It's something very contested and completely from, you know, from the value sphere.
Yeah. So could we conclude that schools are not fit for purpose at the minute, because, you know, they're not light, they're not agile, they're not moving with the times, and the inspection framework that is put upon them in a way keeps them stuck, that they have to do the maths, the science, the geography to get the outcomes, to get the grades, to keep the inspection reports happy.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Schools, you know, there's a lot of creativity. Teachers would like to make much more connections between subjects. They would like to do, you know, use their own creativity to change different methods. There's a lot of, but if you still, at the end of the day, measuring with high stakes, because inspections, you know, make and break careers and even lives, as we have seen recently with the tragic death of Ruth Perry. Exactly. So all of those things are making more difficult to innovate and to look, you know, to have a forward-looking society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why are we not changing?
I think there's a lot of awareness of the problem, but as you just mentioned before, there's also some values here. Mm. And I think, you know, Ofsted has been around from 92 onwards. It has changed a lot in terms of the inspection frameworks, but the vision and this idea that somebody else needs to tell the school of the term, determine what the quality is. It's something very, you know, profoundly in the system, but it doesn't mean that it can't change. And there was recently a campaign called Beyond Ofsted that what they did, Professor Jane Perryman and Alice Bradbury from UCL as well, and they work with NEU, and they surveyed many practitioners, and they look at the literature, and they realize that there is, you know, within the profession, there is a thirst for change, and there is a vision, and there's even a proposal. But of course, there's a political battle to win. And I see as completely possible to see a complete change of this type of system.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, there's a political battle to be won. Yeah. And what's the crux of that battle? What are the obstacles and what are the barriers to change?
I think it's, for example, one very good example of change, of radical change, is happening at this moment in Wales. Mm-hmm. So they used to have the Ofsted inspection system, and they realized that the unintended effects were bigger, you know, and inequality was growing, because this also produced more inequality at the system level. Because the grades that you obtain through inspection are highly correlated with the socioeconomic composition of students.
Yes. Yeah.
So Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, the whole area of school effectiveness is trying to, you know, it's very difficult to say what is the quality of a school, because we know that from, if you look at the outcomes, the, you know, the final output of the system, we know that parental education, income, if the children have free school meals, all of these variables have a huge impact mm-hmm. on the final outcome. So the idea is how to disentangle what is out of the school control to really understand what the school is doing, because otherwise it will appear as, you know, a school that is stuck up in the, going back to the original definition of stuck of the American colleagues. There could be, you know, practice that is not changing, but it's just that they have very, those children have very strong cultural capital. So
it might be what we might call here added value.
Exactly.
So, yes. Yeah. No matter where your starting point, it's what are you adding as a school that's important.
Yeah. And the way of looking at that is looking at the relative progress. So taking into account the starting point and the ending point and see how much progress there was there in comparison with other schools that are facing the same challenges. Mm-hmm. And that I'm really, you know, that was my enter into this debate. It was about value added because I did my PhD estimating the value added of schools and then, seeing which, you know, is not perfect, but is more fair than progress 8 and other indicators we have now. Mm. And so, well, but you were asking me about this change system. So Wales realized that they were, you know, things were looking worse than before. And they decided to change the inspection system. They also changed the curriculum. They put the community at the center. And the change has meant that they have redefining the role of inspection and developing new, you know, have a lot of professional development opportunities for those inspectors and changing the way it works. Mm-hmm. So now it's much more about self-improvement and support for that school to get where they want to go. Mm-hmm. So it's a completely different contract, if you wish, and the role of inspection is very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds not dissimilar to the system we have in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. We have an inspection system. It's rigorous. It's difficult. It's challenging. There's no stone left unturned. But I would say it's a much more human system. Mm-hmm. There's a big emphasis given to, you know, the personal, the pastoral, and, you know, the child at the center of what's going on. And one of the things that happens in inspection here is it's almost like the school is pitted against itself. So mm-hmm. the inspectors will come in, they will look, for example, at the school's development plan, mm-hmm. and then they will begin to, you know, find evidence of how well the school is going in accordance to how it has set out its own plans. Mm-hmm. And then they'll measure, you know, how well it has done against what it has said it will do. Now, obviously, there are comparisons with other schools and so forth as well. But I have to say, they're largely schools of a type, and they're largely schools of a type with similar socioeconomic backgrounds and so on. We've grammar schools here in Northern Ireland still. So, you know, you wouldn't find a secondary school, you know, directly compared against a grammar school, for example.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And if you think, so some years ago, I did with Professor Melanie Aaron a comparison of the four inspection systems in the UK. Mm. So we looked at Northern Ireland and we looked at the work in Scotland and Wales and England. And a difference that it was really important is that there was more interest in social justice, in how you make sure that opportunities are there, and how you take into account the context of the school. And in England, the system looks much more into this idea of social mobility rather than social justice. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, is consistent then in the macro level with the policies we create. So we articulated that as, you know, we looked at all the policy documents that each of the inspectorates have generated, and reconstruct the theory of action in terms of how each of them are intending to improve the system. But something really interesting that we also found is that these systems make difference at the school level, but also at the system level. Mm-hmm. So, for example, by reporting the results of the inspection, by making them public, they give information to parents. They do, you know, other things that work at the system level that, of course, go beyond each individual school. And also they have this powerful opportunity, each of the inspectorates, to identify good practice and to bring that to the attention to the whole system.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
So what I'm saying is, it's not about let's get rid of inspectorates. Mm-hmm. The point is how they can better support the school improvement process and recognize that you need to compare like with like. And when we have inequality at the starting point, if you don't take that into account, then any comparison without taking those things into account will make it unfair. It will make unfair conclusions about the results.
Definitely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Bernie, am I right in saying that Ofsted have said that school improvement is not their job?
Yeah.
They've made that claim, haven't they?
Yes. Yes. And, you know, to an extent, I understand that, because otherwise they will be marking their own homework. But it's very... then it's very difficult to, so, you know, you really need to think carefully then of what, how this should work, because Ofsted, according to their own, you know, theory of action, they think that through feedback, through, you know, the identification of things to improve and reporting back to school, through this feedback mechanism, the school will be able to improve. Mm-hmm. And there are other partners that are in charge of improvement, which, you know, I understand the logic. The problem is there, as we were mentioning before, there are unintended consequences that make more difficult for schools to improve. So if we make, you know, if we think in a metaphor and we compare the inspection system to going to the GP, going to the doctor, it will mean that just visiting the GP or taking a test will make you ill. So that's, you know, something really risky, because then schools that are, maybe they need some support through the inspection system, through reporting their grades, you're making more difficult for them to improve. So in a way, it's, you know, it's really difficult to then support those schools that are working in the most challenging contexts.
Mm-hmm.
That's, yeah. You know, that's something we found in the study of the stuck schools, that the inspection itself had a predictive negative effect in the improvement of the school.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell me more about that. How did that come about?
Well, we looked at... So we did some quantitative analysis, and we took the sample of 580 stuck schools, and we compared them with the national sample. And we realized that there were some stuck schools that are, you know, because the definition of stuck is according to inspection grades, mm-hmm. we saw that some of those schools had positive value added, so they have progressed the children have improved their academic mm-hmm. outcomes, but they still were stuck. And the other way around, some schools were not stuck were not improving their academic outcomes. So we realized that those things are not necessarily hand in hand. And that was something really, you know, concerning in terms of how that worked. So we did an analysis, a statistical analysis that is called path analysis. So you see what it's not causal analysis, but at least it allows you to identify what come first. Mm-hmm. And we realized that after receiving the first less than good grade, mm-hmm. That generates, that propels a vicious cycle, you know, a very difficult situation in which parents leave. So then the school is less funded because funded is per student. Yeah. You get more teachers leave the school. So mm-hmm. all those things. And then there's also a reputation. So many parents won't, you know, even if the school is improving, they mm-hmm. still will get the sense that, no, this school is not good. Mm-hmm. So all of those things make more difficult for the school to improve. So mm-hmm. that's when we realized that the inspection itself came before other most difficult, after finding the school in most difficult circumstances.
Okay, I get that. I understand that. Mm. But let's for a moment then just assume that if we take a theoretical school, okay, they had an inspection and their grade was poor. And then as you illustrate, parents started leaving, numbers decline. So there are multiple issues hitting the school, which kind of keep it stuck and so on.
Yeah.
Presumably the inspectorate, presumably they had to deliver a report, you know, in good faith on their findings. I mean, they couldn't have claimed, you know, the school was great to prevent it being stuck or falling into decline. You know, they'd have to report as they find.
Yeah, but the decision of making, so for example, in Germany and in other systems that they have this school system, the report goes to the school. And it's not mm-hmm. publicly available for some time. So you leave the school the time to improve. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, by making this result public, mm-hmm. you know it's against the improvement process.
It certainly is. It's yes, I see. Yes, yeah. I suppose we have something of that in Northern Ireland. Yes. And
in which way?
In the German way, I suppose, in that mm-hmm. You know, schools do get kind of you know, an extension almost. And there could be an interim report mm-hmm. published, but the inspectorate mm-hmm. would come back and they would very much be looking for improvement, at which point, you know, the full report would be published and made publicly available. But I have to also say, and I have had some very difficult meetings in offices with inspectors, you do really get a chance to thrash things out mm-hmm. with inspectors. Mm-hmm. You know, we've certainly, as a management, we had some very long and very intense meetings where we challenged some of their findings, and we were able to produce, you know, contrary evidence and so on. And sometimes we convinced them, and sometimes they stuck to their guns and we didn't. But at least the opportunity for that debate is there.
Definitely. I mean, you want an inspectorate that is your critical friend, right? Somebody that will question your assumptions, will ask for evidence, will monitor your work, will really make you improve. Otherwise, we tend, you know, I understand the need of this. But it's not the way that Ofsted is working. I mean, Ofsted gives you a report, mm-hmm. I mean, gives you the first orally, they tell you what happened after 2 days. So, and then they create this report, and it's very, there's no really a space for negotiation. Mm-hmm. Even complaints are extremely difficult. Yeah. And people are afraid. So if you don't trust the inspector, what happens is that schools perform for inspection. As if you were doing a performance in a play, you know, in the theater, and they do things that are not their everyday practice because it's high stakes.
I do know the inspectorate. You know, in Northern Ireland, they used to come and they used to meet staff. Mm-hmm. You know, well in advance, maybe a few weeks, you know, before the inspection. Mm-hmm. And I do remember one occasion, the entire staff was packed into our staff room, and you always get a great atmosphere mm-hmm. at days like that. And I remember the lead inspector telling us that he didn't want to see show lessons.
Yeah.
He didn't want to see a performance, and he didn't want us to act or in any way change what we did, that what he really wanted to do was to come in and just see exactly what the school was like. And I remember at the end of that meeting, and I think that was quite long, you know, I think that was maybe an hour and a half, that, you know, he had questions. But I remember at the end of the meeting, people were staying behind and they were talking in groups and so on. And no one believed it. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It, I mean, it was like, you know, we're being duped. If we just be ourselves, you know, this isn't going to go well. So, you know, critical friend is a difficult term to associate with inspectors. There are trust issues. There are fear issues. We are aware of everybody is susceptible to biases and personal biases. And I think everybody changes, and everybody raises their game, and everybody tries to jump through the hoops that they think the inspector are going to expect.
Yes. So that's, you know, that's what I'm saying. When there is low trust, it's in both ways. And, but we could imagine, and there are other places as example in the world where the inspection system is really, it starts from a trust relationship. And mm-hmm. imagine you could really share the struggles, and they could point to the best practice, and you know, it could be a different model where really you could think of how to bring in the voices of students, because at the moment they are the, you know, those are the big silence. The school system at the end of the day, it's for those students and for those families. Mm-hmm. But the inspection systems, what they're doing is that they are geared to report back to the central system.
Well, now, in Northern Ireland, Bernie, the views of students and the views of parents mm-hmm. would be taken and very seriously taken and very seriously considered. Now, how many or what percentage of parents would actually respond? I mean, that might be another matter. And during the actual inspection, you know, we used to get a list of pupils. It was just a random list. And those pupils would have to be in the canteen or somewhere where an inspector or two would talk to them about, well, very much every aspect of the school. And the student voice is very much listened to here in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I think that's a huge difference with here. I think it's much more listened. But, you know, I would like to have students inputting into what they think a good education looks like. The same for parents. So, you know, even though we are, to an extent, the four inspectorates in the UK are considering parents and students, I think they could play a much stronger role in defining what matters and how we know, you know, how we collect that data, etc. Mm-hmm. So I think there's much more room for a more participatory type of inspection. Mm-hmm. For example, my younger child's primary school was just inspected, and we got a letter from Ofsted, and there were 19 hours to respond to the survey in terms of parental views.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, you know, it's not that, enough.
Well, not only is it not enough, Bernie, but, you know, it's shockingly bureaucratic. It's terribly impersonal. In fact, it's downright, you know, rude. It is such an obstacle. It's almost designed so that parents don't have time to respond. How does that come about? How does that level of, you know, slow, draconian bureaucracy, how does that come about?
I don't know. That's a question for you. I only been here 15 years. You know, but I think that, you know, there are some similarities of this type of system in the home office, in other types of systems. And I think they have to do with history and, you know, it's a long history.
I understand. It's just, you know, to the observer, it's just one of those things that really, really gets people's backs up. It really, really rubs them the wrong way from the very outset. Why not give a decent period of time?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why not? Surely you're going to get a much truer picture, especially, I think, from parents as well.
Yeah.
You know, who are busy, who do other things. And, you know, it's maybe not a top priority to fill a form in for Ofsted.
Yeah.
But with a little bit of time, a little bit of support and guidance, and maybe allow the school to say to them, look, you've had this letter. Here's what we would like you to do. But we do want you to be honest and so on. But here's how you'll do it. And I don't know.
Yeah. So, you know, there's some small, simple changes. For example, by planning the school visit. At the moment, the inspections are very short notice. You know, 1-2 days. Mm-hmm. And that's put the whole system under stress. Those things could definitely change, and make it more, you know, friendly and oriented to really listen to the voices of those of the end users.
I think you're absolutely right on that, because again, you know, now this is just me, but the psychology of that is, you know, we're trying to trick you. We're trying to find out. We're going to call in unannounced, and we're going to see you warts and all. And the implication is we hope you're doing something wrong, and we'll see it. We'll find out.
Yeah.
And the amount of trepidation and fear that causes is it's very counterproductive to good teaching.
Yeah, and what we know about learning, that you really, it's about trust. You need to take risks. You need to make mistakes. You need to develop that resilience. You need to, you know, all those things that we think, you know, are in theory there when we are training initial teachers, for example.
Exactly.
And then we create the system. And then we have this huge crisis of retention. And teachers are saying that one of the reasons that they want to, you know, not be in the profession is because they're doing tasks that are unproductive because of all this accountability. Mm-hmm. That plays a huge part of it. Mm-hmm. So it's not just inspections and what's going on, but it's also here is the future of the whole system.
Mm-hmm. So, Bernie, that's a good view of what's happening. Inspectors are people too, and I'm not sure as individuals, you know, they necessarily support the structures and the frameworks that are put on them. But what can be done? What could be positive then that could help build bridges of trust, at least build bridges of trust initially, and maybe over a period of time, you know, change the system and the framework of inspection that would be more human, more supportive, and would lend itself to, you know, improved outcomes for teachers and for children?
I think we have a lot to learn from systems where there's higher trust. Mm-hmm. So this idea of maybe the finding together, when it's a good date for inspectors to come, mm-hmm. Removing the overall grades because it's so reductionist. And, yes. You know, then we don't read all the rich feedback that could come in the inspection report. We just get the 1, 2, 3, 4. And, you know, that's completely counterproductive.
And Bernie, I know I kind of we wanted to move towards something positive now, and we'll come back to that in a second. But surely the fact that there's only a handful of grades in England, surely that must keep a school stuck. It's very hard if you've only, how many grades have you got in England?
4.
So you've only 4. Well, it must be very hard to get up out of them. They've only got 4 categorizations. Surely definitely. That must keep schools very stuck.
Yeah, I mean, by definition, stuck are those that get grade 3 and 4, so requiring improvement or inadequate over time. So that's really not helping. But so you know what? I was thinking. So during all the research, so after the quantitative analysis we did with stuck schools, we conducted case studies in 16 schools. Mm-hmm. 10 of them were stuck and 6 were unstuck. Mm-hmm. And in many of these, they described that the Ofsted inspector that came to their school was supportive, mm-hmm. and gave them, you know, they connected with other networks, and they developed this, as I was describing before, this critical friendship.
Yes.
So there is room for that. And that was even described by those schools that have had the most tough inspections. Mm-hmm. So I think that's also really important to see that maybe there is room for improving through professional development and through shaping what their role is. And even if they're not completely responsible for school improvement, I think they need to play a bigger role there. If we think, you know, in the positives and how things could improve, the inspector could meet with the improvement team. They could work together and they could monitor what's going on later on. So,
you know. Yeah. You see, I do think one of the issues is that the inspectorate have, I don't like this, it's a very American phrase, but they've got no skin in the game.
Yeah.
In other words, there are no consequences for an inspector. No matter what they conclude after their inspection, they walk away and they're on to another school or whatever, and they leave, you know, destruction or success in their wake.
Yeah.
So there are no consequences for them. And I do think that's a big problem.
Definitely. And I really like the example of the Chinese in the Chinese medical system, that you get better pay or better incentives if the people are healthier. Mm. So, you know, we could look at the other way around, that inspectors get more recognition or more, you know, work when schools progress and improve after they come, you know. So there is something that we should really think carefully about their role and how, and they, I definitely think that they need to have also high stakes.
I do think
it's powerful. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And less adversarial.
Yeah.
But I would want to avoid a situation where there's any corruption.
Exactly. <You know? laughs>
Definitely.
Yeah.
Bernie, we're going to take just a short break and we will be right back after these messages.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
School absence, a seemingly ever-present feature in our news at the moment, has raised its head again, this time in the form of fines for parents. The Guardian covers the detail that fines in England for unauthorised absence are set to rise by 33%. Education Secretary Gillian Keegan said she was bringing penalties under a national framework to help tackle inconsistencies. The Department for Education said fines must be considered if a child misses 5 days of school for unauthorised absence. Under the new rules, the initial penalty notices will increase from £60 to £80 per parent per child. Anyone who cannot pay within 21 days will have to pay £160 rather than the current £120. Schools will also share daily registers online with the Department for Education as part of the drive to improve. ASCL's Jeff Barton said the wider issues linked with poor attendance, such as anxiety, disengagement with education and wider social problems, needed addressing by working with families rather than fining them. Labour's Bridget Phillipson said the Conservative government was only just waking up to the damage of persistent absence, but that they should address the causes rather than the symptoms. The Daily Mail highlights the continuing difficulties faced by some schools in recruiting appropriate specialist staff for some subject areas. It reports on one school's desperation and the measures they have had to take by putting large numbers of pupils into masterclasses to support the teaching of science GCSE. Whilst the article describes the decision as a drastic measure, it points out that there is a nationwide crisis in teacher recruitment and retention, and government missing its teacher training targets yet again. Schools are increasingly using non-specialist teachers to cover classes, so the masterclass approach could be here to stay for a little while longer. School holidays featured in the news again, with the debate centering on the long summer break. It prompted much discussion on social media, and teachers, school staff and parents all joined in the debate. The Guardian, however, chose to focus on the benefits one school trust said it had noticed, this time in the area of staff attendance and well-being. The Unity Schools Partnership Trust found that staff absences fell by 50% after it extended the autumn half term by a week in both its primary and secondary schools. Pupil illness absence also fell by 25%. 58% of parents supported the change, which is now permanent, although parents of younger children expressed worries around childcare. In Wales, the BBC reports that the government has admitted to failing to follow the law when stopping free school meals during the holidays after the summer of 2023. Two families and a legal charity claimed ministers had not considered the rights of children. The government accepted it should have done more to assess the effect of the decision, but the Education Minister in Wales said the government could not afford to reintroduce the meals. The government will have to pay the legal costs of the claimants. Finally, the BBC also focuses on a scheme in one Lancashire high school which is encouraging students to embrace phone-free days. Pupils are able to hand in their mobile phones before lessons, and pupils themselves report greater focus and fewer distractions. But the school leaders also report reductions in incidents of bullying and online abuse. Esther Jai, mother of murdered schoolgirl Brianna Jai, has also had a video meeting this week with PM Rishi Sunak to discuss her campaign for greater online safety and an age limit for smartphones. She described the meeting as really productive. Schools were issued new guidance on mobile technology in February of this year. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Joe Fox.
Hello and welcome back to this evening's programme. Bernie and I are talking about stuck schools following Ofsted inspections. I think we've covered five big things. We've talked about how inspections can themselves keep schools stuck. We've looked at values, you know, the politics of school and how the values and the function of schools can keep them stuck. We've looked at the socioeconomics, different schools, different areas, different catchments are problematic, and it means direct comparisons are difficult. And the release of reports too quickly into the public domain is problematic. Probably fourthly, we've looked at the need for a system that is supportive. And maybe the fifth big thing I think we've looked at, Bernie, is how there needs to be much more trust between teachers and inspectors. Gosh, that's an awful lot we've covered in a short while.
We have.
We really? And I'm sure I've left a lot out as well.
Yeah, that's...
You've done a lot of thinking about schools and inspections and so on. Mm-hmm. Bernie, setting everything aside, what would be the ideal? What do you envision as being an ideal system for, you know, checking what's going on in schools that's human and so on?
I think we need to bring in much more well, when you build trust, there's also, if we remove this idea that schools need to compete and we give incentives for schools to collaborate, there's this possibility that good practice is already in the system, but you have something, I have something else. And this type of collaboration could be really powerful. And that's one of the things that we found for the unstuck schools. So I was mentioning before that when we conducted the 16 case studies, we look at schools that had been stuck for over the decade with 3 or 4 less than good overall grades in their inspections. But also we focused on 6 3 primaries and 3 secondaries that managed to first be stuck for 10 years. Mm. And then in the last inspection, they got a good grade. Mm. And one of the characteristics that these schools had is that they created these collaborations and these networks, and so they didn't move on their own. Mm. And these collaborations were not necessarily what you would expect, like from the school improvement or from the multi-academy trust. Sometimes it was the neighbor school, and it was through personal connections of leaders. Mm. So we thought that that was really, really important, that is this sense that we need to look at school quality much more in a specific area rather than school by school, because otherwise it's really, you know, everybody's trying to compete to get those students that are most easy to educate.
Yeah.
And we end up, yeah. So if we look at an overall area, or, you know, local education authority or geographical space, where we look at how all of these schools are improving and what type of specific things they are collaborating. Mm-hmm. I think there's much more room there for meaningful and efficient improvement.
Mm. I'm really glad you put that in the context of how a school gets unstuck, because I do think it's important, you know, we explore that for a moment or two. So yeah. Collaboration and networks, you think, is absolutely key. And what I really liked was, what I really like about that is, you know, you brought it down to the person. It's an actual individual. It's a principal. It's a head of department. It's a newly qualified teacher. Maybe making some kind of relationship or connection with someone else in another school.
Yes. Some of the examples were really interesting. So, for example, a school that has been stuck goes to the what would be a grammar school in the context you were describing in Northern Ireland, that had, you know, much bigger, much, you know, greater facilities, sports, and so on. And they said, you know, send me your new qualified teachers, because if they come to teach in my school, they will really develop better classroom. They will know how to really, you know, improve their classroom management. This is real. It's more challenging teaching in this school than in your other school. And then I will send my children to do sports in your school. So they were rotating and agreeing on these type of collaborations.
Well, I'm glad you said that was a mutual collaboration and a mutual exchange, because I'm not quite sure the world of grammar schools and secondary schools in Northern Ireland always see eye to eye in that way. But having said that, the last decade in Northern Ireland has seen formal collaborations. You know, we all have our cluster groups. We all have our area learning communities and so on. Mm-hmm. And we all have our in-service days together. Yeah. And we would have, certainly in the school I taught in, we would have a large number of pupils going across to, I suppose we had three grammar schools around us that would have gone to all three.
Yes.
And we would have had children from the grammar schools and their uniform coming to us. That worked well. It worked very well.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily the teachers coming, but at least the children were coming.
Yeah. Mm. So I think, you know, schools are very much, you know, creative, and they know what they can, what they want to improve on, and they know what the resources are, and they can find ways of finding mutual benefits. So another characteristic that we found in this Unstuck, it was this distributed leadership. So head teachers and leaders in general were telling us how it wasn't them being, you know, superheroes. It was about giving other teachers, middle leaders, the opportunities to lead and to learn. And they talk about homegrowning their own teams because it was very difficult to recruit, but also it was an opportunity to then making good practice much more consistent, because most of these schools had pockets of very good practice and pockets of very bad practice, as you probably are aware that this is the case in most of schools. Mm-hmm. Schools are not consistently good in all areas or with all types of students. Mm-hmm. So they really stress this importance of distributed leadership. Mm-hmm. They also had this, what we call moral purpose. So staff that work in these schools, they felt a strong vocation to work hard and make a difference in the life of these children that were coming from the most disadvantaged areas. Yeah. This was beyond, you know, they work really, really hard, and their motivation was to make a difference in this school, in these children, in these children's lives. Mm-hmm. And that was very important.
Where does that come from, Bernie? Do we know?
As in, I think most of teachers go to the profession wanting to make a difference. It's just that in this context, it's much more stark, in the sense that if the school doesn't make the difference, who will? So I think that's the ones who stay are those that are really looking at, you know, maybe small scale improvements, long-term relationships with these families and these communities. And they can see, you know, that was really fulfilling for them, despite, you know, the difficulties.
I like that. I can't help thinking that's a very powerful aspect of helping a school to change and maybe get unstuck.
And another characteristic was this idea that they need to stabilize the team. So if you look at, for example, teachers turnover, head teachers turnover over the last decade, there would be 3, 4, 5 head teachers over the decade, and these head teachers and these middle leaders, they say we need to stay, and they were thinking, and in fact, they managed to get unstuck after 3 years of being in post. Mm-hmm. So there's something here about time and about, you know, letting those green shoots really bloom before you cut, you know. So there is a need to reduce the frequency of inspections or showing results in a way that, you know, will really let these schools really make changes, because you need time for those real changes.
Bernie, if I put you in touch with the leadership at Manchester United, could you talk to them about stabilizing the team?
Yes, I can show you the data, because, you know, before
I
we have the data
here.
For this.
I'm joking.
At least right. 3 years. Will be the, you know, you really need that.
Yeah, but there's something about that, isn't there? And there's something about, I always like, I do like football, but one of the reasons I like watching football and the managers and so on, it is a microcosm of, it's an intense cauldron or microcosm of what can maybe work in a school. And mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. Teams that change their managers every 6 months, I mean, the unsettling effect must be huge on the players.
Yeah.
So there's something about consistency. There's something definitely about, you know, a bigger purpose with
yes.
footballers. I think, again, in schools we call it distributed leadership, but I suppose in the team it's about every player, you know, taking that responsibility, and some of them play a bigger role some weeks than others.
Yes.
That's excellent. Yeah.
Yeah, that was mm-hmm. that's really important. Another key one was this positive relationships with parents and the community.
Oh,
so
yes,
it's really changing the type of conversation. So most of these schools, what they did was they started calling home when there was good things to report.
Yes.
And parents at the beginning was like, you know, what went wrong? And it's just that your child did something fantastic today. So really changing the dynamic and diversifying the way teachers could contact parents. So there was much more use of technology, not expecting parents to be at school in parent evenings, etc. So understanding the ways families work, etc., and in general, starting with positive communication, really was a key aspect of all these unstuck schools.
Yeah,
and of course, strong internal governance and accountability. So, the accountability we've been thinking about is this vertical accountability coming from outside the school, but you have to have your own internal systems to understand when and identify when something needs to change and report that within the system and being timely with that type of responses. So all of them had these internal ways of monitoring their own work. Opening classrooms to observations, making the practice of teachers open to other teachers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And also all of them put very clear approaches to behavior, and some of them had really, really, I would say, very disciplined systems with, you know, quiet corridors, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But these were not all the schools. So, you know, two out of the six unstuck had mm-hmm. that type of policy. The others make very consistent systems mm-hmm. of behavior that everybody agreed on and worked towards good practice and behavior in general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that transmit this vision of high expectations, you know, irrespective of the context that they were working on. I think that was also a key point.
Oh, I think that's very important, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's
now,
crucial.
All of those points, all the, these nine key factors that I'm describing that unstuck schools had are not different from all the literature on what America called the turnaround schools. this the unstuck would be, you know, called the turnaround. Mm-hmm. And in general, they're very similar to the factors of that we know of school effectiveness and improvement in every type of school.
Yes, yes.
So I think that's important because it's not that these schools need something very different. Mm-hmm. It's just that, you know, it's the combination of these, or what would be maybe then the first way, where do you start, will be these. But, but I found that that's really interesting that, you know, it's very similar and it's in line with what is already known about how you improve a school.
Mm-hmm. And to anybody listening, and there will be people listening who are maybe in stuck schools and in a position to, you know, have some impact or effect.
Yeah.
Where do you start in those nine categories, or do you just kind of start everywhere, or is there?
I think for me it would be the networks and external support, start to looking at the assets, because many of these schools are located in a place where they think they are on their own, but they are not. And there are many other schools that have gone through the same type of trajectory. So learning from them, I think, is key, because many of these schools, they feel disempowered if a very, you know, an outstanding school comes and said, you know, this is the way you should be doing things, because they think, you know, they don't get it.
Yeah.
So there's nothing like finding someone that has gone through something very similar to you to really start working together. So for these schools, what makes the difference is somebody that is a few steps ahead, but not coming from, you know, the gospel, because then it really is disempowering.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's for me the number one, is to really look at where are the assets, what opportunities I have in my community or around, or, you know, the list of stuck schools is public. So you can even pick up the phone and call how these schools manage to, you know, what they did, and talk between these head teachers and these leaders.
Gosh, it's actually quite shocking, isn't it, when you actually say that in a sentence, the list of stuck schools is public.
Yeah.
It really is. It is the naughty list, isn't it?
And, you know, that's one of the most difficult aspects, is this is this reputational damage that takes a long time for these schools to move out of.
You would nearly think as well, you know, the stuck school that's trying its best to be unstuck, that, you know, they would need some protection, some help, and some protection from the glare of public scrutiny and, you know, the hemorrhaging of parents and children away from them.
Definitely. Yeah. So, for example, we saw that only for secondary schools that were stuck, there was a positive impact of being part of an academy.
Yes.
That helped stabilizing the teams. Mm-hmm. But we didn't see any positive effects for primary stuck schools being part of an academy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very, very, you know, it's a shame, because a lot of resources have gone into academization and for these schools to, and incentives for academies to bring these schools into their networks. And this is not working for all of them.
Were there any reasons found out why that's the case, Bernie?
We think because the academy system is much more geared to secondary schools in general.
Okay. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah.
Whereas for primary schools that tend to be smaller teams, as you know, the scale is very different, and maybe they need a different type of support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. We don't really have the academy system in Northern Ireland. We certainly don't have it in the way that, you know, it exists in England.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right in saying that if a school doesn't do well in a number of inspections, it can lose its status and become part of an academy. Did I read that somewhere?
Yeah. If you get a grade four, if you get if you are rated inadequate and put mm-hmm. into special measures, you're forced to academize.
And what's the thinking behind, is the thinking behind that, that, you know, you're in a group of schools and therefore you're going to, you know, get support, you're going to...
Yeah, everything will be done at scale. There will be yes. more experience and you can get that support. But also it's again a political move to thinking that, because there's no evidence that says that academies are better than local education authorities.
Yeah.
So is this idea that every school should become an academy by 2030, say, but there's no really evidence to support that. Mm-hmm. So it's also a way of implementing that policy, if you wish, I think.
Yeah, I can see that too, yeah. Mm-hmm. And can schools then get out of the academy, out of that trust system?
Yeah, I mean, in some cases they change to a different academy, or we saw that this sometimes when they didn't get the support they wanted. So they can change to a different type. And those that were more local in general were perceived as better for these schools. Mm-hmm. So somebody that could really understand the context where they were working in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bernie, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you.
I can say the same.
Thoroughly enjoyed it, yeah. Towards the end of every program, it's kind of traditional, I do ask a question. If you had a magic wand and only one spell to cast, what change would you make to education that would significantly improve the lot of teachers?
That will improve the life of teachers?
Or? That would improve the lot or the life of teachers, yeah.
So if I had a magic wand and I could one spell to improve, I don't know if I heard you right, if I to improve their lives?
It would, to improve, you know, conditions for teachers. Yeah.
Yeah. I would start with high prestige in the system so that the most prestigious thing you could do is teaching, because I do think it's really the most important job. And that should be, you know, even more than medicine or anything. It's really the ending of the whole society. So give that recognition in all areas of society. Wow, of course, including pay, but it's much beyond than pay.
And in a way, that brings us back to the start, you know, when you mentioned countries like Finland and so on, where teachers are much more revered.
Exactly. I mean, it's well studied.
Mm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
Bernie, that's our time up. It has been great spending time with you. I've enjoyed every minute. So much ground that we've covered. There's probably five or six more shows that we could do. But look, thank you so much for your time, Bernie.
Thank you, Paul. It's been really, really interesting and thought-provoking. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Bye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.